From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If you were wondering how the Justice Department thought it could get away with firing 8 federal prosecutors on the thinnest of pretexts, now you have an answer. 8 is a lot fewer than 93. And that, we now know, is how many the White House believed should be canned. Emails documenting that recommendation surfaced this week, resulting in the resignation of a top aide to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. The email suggests that the so-called Gonzalez 8 may have been fired for going too hard on Republicans in their districts or too soft on the Democrats. Now, a few years ago, 2 communications professors, Donald Shields and John Cragen, had a hunch that something odd was afoot in justice, so they set out to catalog federal investigations and indictments of some 375 elected officials. Cragen was struck by what he found.
What we found is that about 7 to 8 out of 10 times they investigated a Democrat over a Republican. And the statistical analysis says that the chances of that happening by random are about 1 in 10,000. There are roughly 50% Democrats and 41% Republicans and 9% independents nationally. So if they were doing their job, we should have found an investigation rate of that same ratio. Instead, we found 79% Democratic, about 17% Republican, and the rest of the few percents independent.
Now, just to be clear, all the entries in your database are investigations or indictments that were previously reported in the media, right?
Yes. What we looked at were posted news stories by journalists.
So it's possible that the number of investigations could be a lot higher since a lot of the original stories were launched on leaks.
Exactly. I mean, that's our point, is that it's a sad state of affairs in this country when a couple unfunded, you know, university professors are having to gather this data. And we can't even get data of who was convicted, you know, who is currently indicted. And God knows you can't get data on who's investigated because the powers of a secret grand jury investigation.
So you actually don't have any idea how close your numbers reflect what the disparity between Republicans and Democrats is.
We only have data on what has been put on the public record. That is entirely correct. However, when you got large numbers like we have, if 10 more cases were released, this ratio is not going to change.
So why haven't any reporters up until now been able to connect the dots?
Well, 2 reasons. One is these stories tend to be local stories, and so the average reporter is reporting a corruption investigation in Minneapolis or one in Detroit. And if it's not a senator or a high-profile congressperson, odds are it never gets on the national spotlight. And the reporters that are doing the big picture stories never see these other stories. The second reason is that there isn't a national register where any reporter in a click of a mouse could see a running total of how many politicians have been investigated, charged, convicted, and what party they're at. This data, I mean, we tried. You can't get it any other way than the way we did.
But are you sure that what you've uncovered is, as you call it, political profiling? I mean, if the investigations of Democrats result in, say, convictions, isn't that proof enough that the investigations have been justified?
Well, when we change administrations and we now have attorneys appointed by a Democratic president, if we find that 8 out of 10 of the politicians indicted were Republicans, we'd say, I think the system's broke. On the other hand, if it turns out we continue to have, you know, 8 out of 10 indictments being Democrats, well, then maybe we've got a corrupt political party. But the way it stands now, you can't reasonably argue it either way.
If the 8 prosecutors who were fired because of their political independence, does that mean the prosecutors who are still in their jobs were functioning as party hacks?
Well, you know, you wind up sounding like such a conspiratorial nut, you know, when you try to respond to that. But, you know, you say, gee, if this whole selection has been heavily political loyalty, you know, and ideological purity, maybe we should worry about the Gonzalez 85 and not the Gonzalez 8. It's scary. It really scares me.
Here's the question that ends almost every interview. How do you think the media should be reporting this story?
Well, I mean, the average journalist is up against it because it's always catch 22 when they go ask a U.S. attorney and say, well, we heard a leak that you're looking at this politician. Can you confirm or deny? I can neither confirm or deny. Then the burden is thrown on the reporter. The reporter has to make a professional decision. Should I take this leak that's been given to me and put this person's name in print because just being accused can be such a political liability? Or should I not tell this story? What is my duty to the public? And so what happens when we fear, you know, for the independence of our U.S. attorneys, the journalist fears their ability to do their job. So it screws up the Fourth Estate along with our judicial system, in other words.
John, thank you very much.
Okay.
John Cragen is a communications professor at the University of St. Thomas. We'll link to his study at our website at onthemedia.org. One thing that became clear this week is that most of the Justice Department serves at the, quote, pleasure of the president. Attorney General Gonzalez said it.
I work for the American people, and I serve at the pleasure of the President of the United States, and he'll decide whether or not I continue to serve as the Attorney General.
We kept hearing it, but what does it really mean? I asked Slate's legal expert and senior editor, Dahlia Lithwick.
What it means, in effect, is that under the constitutional structure that we have today and that we've had for hundreds of years, these are all positions that can be appointed by the executive branch, that the president fills these positions and they serve as long as he likes what they're doing. He could fire them tomorrow under this theory for anything, for cause, for no cause, for the color of their hair.
I guess the question that is really bothering me is, if the president has the right to remove this whole layer of prosecutors, how independent is the judicial branch in the end?
The check against all this was never that the president couldn't fire them. The check was that he couldn't put in place new ones in their positions without oversight. The president or the attorney general could appoint a new one. They could only serve for 120 days, at which point they needed to be confirmed by the Senate. That's your congressional check. If the Senate failed to confirm her, that U.S. attorney could not continue to serve, then the district judges in that district would appoint the new U.S. attorney. So then you have the judicial branch checking. Now that changed because of the part of the scandal that's probably least understood, which is a change in the Patriot Act. The provision that was sort of snuck into the Patriot Act and that the Congress voted for said, okay, now there's no longer any check. Those people don't just serve 120 days. They serve indefinitely.
Okay, so then what do you think of the spin that's been floated by a lot of Republicans and some of the conservative media that the current firings, as the Wall Street Journal said, are business as usual, that the Clintons did it even worse?
That particular counterexample is absolutely inapposite and I think unfair. And nobody expects, when a new president from an opposing party comes in, that all the U.S. attorneys would continue to serve. Because, as I said, these are political appointments. They go to people whose views comport with yours. So to say, wait a minute, you know, George Bush only fired 8, Clinton fired 93, is to sort of, I think, lose the point. There's a difference between putting 93 new people in at the beginning of your term and getting rid of 8 of them in the middle of their term because you don't like that they're not going after Democrats. So it's a very inept and, I think, unfair comparison.
How well do you think the media have done in sort of combing through whether this is normal or not normal?
A fairly rotten job, truth be told. I sort of laughingly refer to it as piece A or piece B. Piece A is the sort of indignant, horrified, you know, politics has never tainted the doings of the Justice Department. You know, Gonzalez should be impeached if not shot. That's sort of piece A. And piece B is the sort of, oh, this happens all the time. The Clintons did it even more. You know, it's typical liberal, you know, hysteria to suggest that there's anything new here. And I think that both of those things sort of distort the reality, and it seems to me that that comparison of, you know, Bush fired 8, Clinton fired 93 is so absolutely irrelevant to the current debate that the fact that we're still having a conversation about those two numbers is really emblematic of the problem of how sort of lazy we've been.
All right. Dahlia, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate.
Well, obviously, I think that there were mistakes made here. And I think that
poor Alberto Gonzalez. By the time this is heard, the Attorney General of the United States could be out of a job because politically convenient prosecutions were moving at a politically inconvenient pace, and calls to prosecutors were made, and threats were understood, and emails were written, and prosecutors were fired. So in the long tradition of politicians in whose hands cookies have been found, the passive voice was invoked. Because in Washington, that's how things are done. The magical construction was popularized during Watergate by Nixon spokesman Ron Ziegler, and since has become a Washington tense unto itself, dubbed by CNN political analyst Bill Schneider, the past exonerative. In January, for instance, on the subject of Iraq, the past exonerative was invoked by President Bush.
Our troops in Iraq have fought bravely. They have done everything we have asked them to do. Where mistakes have been made, the responsibility rests with me.
Mind, that's not the same as my fault. It's more like the buck stops here. But it wasn't put here by me. I didn't even touch the thing. I mean, the thing wasn't even touched by me. And here's Ronald Reagan in his 1986 State of the Union address when the Iran-Contra scandal was discussed.
It's obvious that the execution of these policies was flawed and mistakes were made. I know the stories of the past few weeks have been distressing. I'm deeply disappointed this initiative has resulted in such a controversy, and I regret it's caused such concern and consternation.
That was a special historical moment because in the non-confession were combined the past exonerative with its non-apology cousin, responsibility once removed. In that case, one need never acknowledge wrongdoing, only others' unhappiness that perhaps a wrong has been done. When Arnold Schwarzenegger was accused of pawing a number of women, for instance, he was heard to utter the classic, "I'm sorry if anyone was offended," which didn't really address his conduct, but apparently was deemed more politically advantageous than, "but they were so hot." Now, it's been pointed out in the editing process that all the examples you have just heard concerned Republicans. If anyone sees this as unfair, I regret it. I accept full responsibility, but I assure you, no mistakes were made.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The big news in the music industry last week was about a, quote, good faith agreement to bring more independent music to the airwaves. Four of the biggest radio station groups, Clear Channel, Entercom Communications, CBS Radio, and Citadel Broadcasting, pledged to devote 8,400 half hours of programming to independent artists. But exactly why would they do that? Well, the indie deal comes fresh on the heels of another radio shakeup. Those same four station groups will also pay a cumulative $12.5 million to settle a consent decree by the Federal Communications Commission targeting the problem of payola. Payola is essentially bribery. It's when stations are paid by record companies or their representatives to play certain songs, and it's plagued radio for as long as there's been radio. The fines slapped on the stations were the product of an investigation that began in New York, where even larger fines were levied. Paul Porter, a former broadcaster, is co-founder of the nonpartisan think tank Industry Ears. He thinks it'll be hard to separate payola from radio. He's seen it firsthand.
Way back when I first got started in the late 70s, payola came in different forms. It could come from a little bag of weed to $50 to a dinner at the Chinese restaurant to a plane ticket. And over the years, it's really turned into big money.
So you're not saying it's gone from a little bag of weed to a giant bag of weed. It's gone corporate, has it?
Yeah, it's gone corporate and the stakes are up. You know, with the Telecom Act and consolidation, you know, there were a lot more owners before this. And, you know, when the Clear Channels of the world went from 40 stations to 1,200 stations in 2 years, you had one corporate playlist and, you know, the stakes went up. So instead of the $50 in a dinner, it's $20,000 in a truck for your radio station and trips to Europe and all the things that the local musician can't compete with.
Payola obviously is corrupt, but the public is harmed specifically. How?
Well, first of all, the airwaves are public airwaves, and radio stations are supposed to reflect forms of localism and news information and even the music that they play in. And when these companies that aggressively were bought in the late 90s, they lost all of that.
We've heard most recently about Payola in a big investigation by then New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. He's now the governor, which in turn led to an FCC investigation that resulted in this landmark settlement. Tell me about that Spitzer case.
What they uncovered was tons of illegal activity. The Spitzer investigation came up with some guidelines and some rules. It hasn't changed Payola, but in total, they came up with $36 million worth of fines that came from various record distribution companies. And once all that stuff got into the limelight, the FCC were forced to investigate.
Well, I mean, the numbers are still big. The fine that these four broadcast conglomerates are paying is $12.5 million.
You think that's big?
That's not chicken feed.
Ah, that's chicken feed when you talk to companies that make billions of dollars. That's going to come out of, you know, a couple of Christmas bonuses. Look, just add it up. If New York State fined for one state $36 million and the FCC, who's the governing body, is fining $12 million for the, you know, I mean, the numbers really don't add up.
And furthermore, nobody has admitted any wrongdoing. What exactly does the consent decree dictate for these broadcasters?
Well, the consent decree basically says they're not guilty of anything, but they're going to put in certain safeguards where they're policing themselves. And if they police themselves in the first place, we wouldn't be at this point. The part of the agreement that really everybody's sort of talking about and thinking is something is the 8,400 hours of independent music that are supposed to be aired on these radio stations in retribution. But this document is not through the FCC. This is a separate agreement.
I thought that the 8,400 hours was in the final agreement.
It's not enforceable by the FCC. That's where everybody's fooled. The FCC announced it, but they have no enforcement oversight at all.
I gather it's your opinion that that this consent agreement is just window dressing and that lobbyists have intimidated the FCC and made them bend to their will. Can you tell me how?
First of all, the RIAA.
The Recording Industry Association of America.
Yeah. When the FCC wanted to add the indie music component, the RIAA's lawyers struck a deal with the FCC to say, hey, man, you do this, we're taking you to court. So the FCC walked away. You know, all I can do is hope that it's a step in the right direction.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Paul Porter is co-founder of the policy group Industry Ears.
If radio consolidation brought a stultifying sameness to music on the airwaves, the internet promised a fresh start. Online, nearly anyone could start a radio station and play whatever they liked. What began as an experiment has become a phenomenon, drawing roughly 72 million listeners each month. Among them are a few of our listeners who told us about a new fee structure to go in effect May 15th, devised by the Copyright Royalty Board, created by Congress. It will boost the cost those webcasters pay to play a song, and many online DJs say it will drive them out of business. Attorney David Oxenford has worked to hold down costs for indie internet radio. He says the upcoming fee hike has not gone unnoticed.
Lots of newspapers have been running articles. We've seen petitions with tens of thousands of signatures already on it. We understand that a number of congressional offices have gotten thousands of calls and emails already. We hope that that continues. I think each and every one of the internet radio stations that's affected by this decision is talking to their listeners right now about the effect.
How do broadcast radio stations pay for the songs that they play?
Broadcast radio stations pay only for the composition. That's basically money that goes to the songwriters, and that's collected by three organizations called ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC.
And so, until now, what are the rules that have governed internet radio?
Internet radio stations pay not only for the composition, the fees that go to ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC, but also a royalty fee that goes for the performance, the actual song that's being played on the air. And that royalty goes to the record companies and also to the artists.
And how much an individual internet radio station pays is tied to some degree to how many people listen to them?
That's been the way that the royalty has been paid by the big webcasters. For the small commercial webcasters, a special deal was negotiated in 2002 that I was involved in on behalf of a number of small webcasters where they paid based on a percentage of their revenue.
So now the Copyright Royalty Board, which was created in 2004, I guess, to assess the situation, reached a decision. What did they decide?
Basically, for the big webcasters, the rates are going up 2.5 times on a per-song, per-listener basis. Also, the Royalty Board decided that they would not offer a percentage of revenue option for any webcaster so that the smaller guys who play lots of songs but aren't bringing in a lot of revenue end up, under the new scheme, having to pay more in royalties than they bring in total revenues.
What about if you're commercial free? In other words, nonprofit?
Well, nonprofit radio stations do have to pay a flat fee for up to a certain amount of listening. And once they get above that certain threshold, they have to pay at the commercial rates. So for some of the big NPR stations, some of the big religious broadcasters, some of the big community radio stations, they're going to be paying at the commercial radio rates about 10 times what they're currently paying.
But the Wall Street Journal said that the fees up until now have been kept, quote, artificially low to encourage a nascent industry.
That's not really true. I don't know where they came up with that because none of the webcasters really have been making any money. There hasn't been much advertising revenue. And so this royalty really has been eating up all the revenues that have been coming into this industry.
We keep hearing that the music industry is supposedly struggling. Doesn't it stand to benefit from the exposure they could get from these, you know, at least the popular internet radio stations?
No question. The internet radio stations, especially a lot of the independent internet radio stations, play all sorts of niche formats, exposing people to all sorts of stuff that's not played on terrestrial radio. And it's really encouraged people to buy CDs that they would never have heard about unless they had heard it on some of these internet radio stations.
What's the recourse for the radio stations you represent? Can they challenge this new fee structure?
Sure. Sound Exchange, the collective that collects these royalties on behalf of the recording industry, can always agree voluntarily to a different set of rates that will allow the independent webcasters to survive. Already, some of the congressional representatives have expressed outrage at the royalty rate and what it will do to diversity on internet radio. We hope that they will actually take some action to preserve internet radio if we can't voluntarily reach a deal that will help us all survive. The first royalties under the decision are due on May 15th, and especially for the smaller webcasters, if there's no relief by May 15th, you may see a lot of them shutting down if the listeners haven't already gotten the message. They'll get it then when they can't hear the music that they love from these internet webcasters.
David, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Oxenford is a media attorney with Davis, Wright, and Tremaine. This week, old media giant Viacom filed suit against new media behemoth Google, claiming $1 billion for copyright infringement. You see, Google owns the video aggregating website YouTube, which plays host to thousands of clips posted by users from programs like MTV's Laguna Beach and Comedy Central's The Daily Show. And, Well, that content is owned by Viacom. The U.S. District Court in New York now has to decide whether Google has violated copyright law, but Google will likely trot out the 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which is a sort of modified intellectual property law for the Internet age. The act contains what is called a safe harbor provision, meaning that as long as Google takes down copyright content when asked to, then everything's okay. So, what gives? Siva Vaidyanathan is an associate professor of culture and communications at New York University, and he joins us now to explain. Siva, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
Do you think that Viacom really means it with this lawsuit? Do they really want to take Google down, or are they trying to do something else?
This is a business move as much as a legal move. In the short term, it's really about negotiating from a position of strength. If they're going to cut a deal with YouTube and Google to allow some of their material to be available on these sites, they're going to want to do it on their own terms. So in that negotiation, they're going to want as much leverage as possible. Filing a lawsuit that basically threatens Google's core business is a really good way to get the upper hand in backroom business negotiations.
You know, it really seems to be a different world. As recently as a year ago, an exec at VH1, which is owned by Viacom, told Variety that, quote, you have to be able to lose control of the media, unquote, in order to effectively promote it. I guess he's singing a different tune now.
Well, you know, Jon Stewart said almost the exact same thing in Wired magazine about a year ago when he was celebrating the fact that so many fans build value into the content of The Daily Show by making clips, by putting them up on the web, and by making sure that other people can link to them. It was a beautiful way to build fan base. Now, we haven't heard a lot from Jon Stewart in the last few months as Viacom's taken these very aggressive stands toward Google and YouTube, but I'd be willing to bet that the folks who really understand how fans build upon the work of The Daily Show, they understand that having stuff up on YouTube is priceless. Being kind to your fans by giving them content that they can use and reuse and sometimes even abuse is never a bad business strategy.
I was thinking of Saturday Night Live's boy band parody. I don't want to run into taste monitors here, so let's just say it was called something along the lines of Male Member in a Box. MVC posted an uncensored version on YouTube where it received more than 17 million views and is ranked as YouTube's third most viewed video of all time. And this has really redounded to Saturday Night Live's benefit. Just like an earlier music video, Lazy Sunday brought a whole new audience to SNL for the first time.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a clearly designed strategy, right? The strategy was they would run the sort of censored version on the actual show and then the uncensored video on YouTube where the FCC would have nothing to say about it. And people who hadn't watched Saturday Night Live in years had a reason to tune back in thinking, hey, it may finally be funny again. Now, the real question, though, is if that's good once in a while, why isn't it a good idea all the time? You know, one of the things we're going to start seeing down the line is whether Google needs these companies more than these companies need Google. And my hunch is that these companies actually need Google more than Google needs any individual source of content.
In the case of Lazy Sunday, it was viewed 5 million times on YouTube, and then NBC told them to take it down.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting because they did let it ride long enough to build an audience and then complained. Under that sort of behavior, that's exactly how the Digital Millennium Copyright is supposed to work, or at least the safe harbor provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. There was a notice, there was a takedown, no harm, no foul, no lawsuit. The world goes on, copyright is preserved for another day, Saturday Night Live goes on another week. And so you could look at that situation and say, from a business point of view, everybody won except the lawyers.
Well, that's what you say. But Viacom says that it spends tens of thousands of dollars a month just patrolling YouTube to find Stephen Colbert clips that it already asked be taken down.
I don't know. You know, look, if they had given proper notice to YouTube and Google, YouTube and Google had a responsibility to take it down right away. And if it didn't, then, of course, you know, going to court is appropriate.
Siva, if the court were to rule against YouTube, what do you think the implications would be for other similar sites?
Well, I think we would probably see a chilling effect within the software industry in the sense that every time someone dreams up the next content delivery platform, their lawyers would say, no, you better be careful because your fans might end up posting copyrighted material and you'd be dealing with a huge legal bill almost immediately. One of the reasons we've had such amazing technological innovation over the past 20 years is that both Congress and the courts have essentially said, we won't hold content delivery companies and technology companies liable for the infringement that fans do. And that meant that we could get tremendous investment in things like the personal computer, the big hard drive. Clearly, one of the reasons that we all want big hard drives is we want to fill them up with MP3s and now video, right? So we want big hard drives to hold copyrighted material.
For our own use.
For our own use, certainly. But somebody's making money off of that. And so the content companies have for just as many decades wanted a piece of that action. Wisely, both Congress and the courts have said, no, you can't have a piece of that action. We need to encourage more investment and more innovation in those areas.
Siva, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Siva Vaidyanathan is the author of Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity. You can find a link to his blog at onthemedia.org.
Coming up, a conversation with Bill Gates and what you should be aware of this week.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As you may know, in his other life, Garfield is a columnist for Advertising Age, and he is pretty much a 900-pound gorilla in that world. Recently, he moderated a panel on the marketing implications of the digital revolution, a panel that included a 9-million-pound gorilla named Bill Gates. Afterwards, Bob sat down with Gates for a brief discussion about the digital future, and in particular, Microsoft's big plans for digital TV.
Let me start with something simple. What happens next?
Well, everything's going digital. Over time, the whole way you record the memories of your kids growing up, that will be digital. The way you think about buying products, how to learn about them, choose them, organize things with your friends, that will be digital. And so these things are bringing together what used to be offline, you know, paper-based, inefficient things onto the internet. TV was a broadcast medium. Now it, too, is coming to the internet. Not as far along as, say, music is, but within the next decade, virtually all the shows you watch will be delivered that way.
The digital world from the PC to the internet to, excuse the expression, iPod, has altered our media behavior on a grand scale, obviously. But the marketing world and even Hollywood, it seems to me, have been very, very slow to catch up. First of all, is the old paradigm the Titanic? And are a lot of people going to go down with the ship?
No, I think it's more evolutionary than that. The idea of creativity, great storytelling, those things exist in the new medium, but you have to take advantage of the new tools and the new ways that you can do that targeting. And so you'll see a little bit more turmoil in terms of who succeeds and who doesn't, but it's not some overnight cataclysm. It's year by year, particularly young consumers, working in a different way, and there's a lot to be proven out here.
You used the word evolution, and I've constantly hear references to the transition from the old model to the new one. But it seems to me that the old model was built both on the content side and on the marketing side by the mass audience, and the new model is all about targeting individuals or very, very narrow groups. Can you evolve from one to the other, or is it really just two entirely different ways of doing business?
You can definitely evolve. If we know what 19-year-olds are watching, even if it's 1,000 different things, technologically letting you buy the space to be on all 1,000 of those things will be as easy as it used to be to buy that single show that everybody was watching at the same time. Advertising will be less on the blind than it has been. So the ability to hit large numbers and even learn to get the feedback of how did they respond to it? Did they click on something? Did they indicate favorability? That means ads that really didn't work will receive less payment. And the ones that work well, that will be clear, and people who do those will get more value.
Tell me about your work with AT&T to develop IPTV, Internet Protocol TV, basically Internet TV. What effect will that have on our consumer habits, and what effect will it have on the broadcast industry?
Well, what we call IPTV is enabled by the fact that the Internet has enough bandwidth to carry even high-definition video signals. So instead of getting just a broadcast signal that goes the same thing to every household, there's data over the internet that's targeted specifically at that TV set. And so if you're watching a news segment, the areas of great interest to you are made longer, and the ones of less interest to you are made shorter. The sports you want are more in-depth. Likewise, the ads are based on what would be interesting to you. So not everybody watching the news show has seen the same ads. And if during that ad you want more information, you just push a button on your remote control and it'll show up in your mailbox, or immediately you'll get more information. But of course, you don't miss any of the show that you're watching at that time.
And what happens to local broadcast stations in this environment?
Well, it's great for them because they have ad buyers take the plumbing shop that serves only a small part of the TV footprint. They can actually buy the viewers that are in their territory and have this ad that only their potential customers are seeing. So that's an advertiser who the old system had such fixed costs of creating an ad and such brute force delivery that it would be too expensive.
Local stations actually broadcast the signal of programming that networks produce. And in exchange for doing that, they get a cut of the revenue. So when I'm watching Lost on my local ABC station or the cable transmission thereof, my local station's getting a cut of the revenue because, after all, they've delivered it to me. But on the Internet Protocol television, is it not going directly from the content producer, let's say the network, directly to my PC or the large screen, just cutting the local broadcaster out of the loop entirely?
No, the way affiliate contracts work is that any method of delivery of that content into the affiliate's region involves that affiliate getting advertising that they get to fill in and some portion of the advertising revenue that is delivered there. Now, these affiliate contracts are always subject to negotiation, but it doesn't matter that it's the internet bringing it in. What matters is that the value of those ad minutes has been increased because somebody who really wants to buy young women is paying more per viewer, and the people who want to buy the young men, they're paying more per viewer. And so as it all adds up, it's a more valuable ad minute, and the affiliate will get whatever their share is of that.
I want to ask you one more thing. Those Mac ads, how do you feel about the John Hodgman character?
Yeah, I can't comment on someone else's ad.
Okay, but he's you.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on someone else's ad.
Okay. Well, Bill Gates, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bill Gates is co-founder and chairman of Microsoft. I had a headache earlier today. I suspect a brain injury, although I may just be sort of hyper aware of my brain these days, this being National Brain Awareness Month. But give me a great deal of thought to my kidneys, too, because this is also National Kidney Month and National Endometriosis Month. To tell you the truth, the more I focus on that, the worse my endometrium feel.
That's the whole idea of awareness observances, to focus the media's attention on issues they don't ordinarily give much thought, and to generate coverage that might otherwise never occur. Last June, Garfield dug into the burgeoning awareness industry.
Edgar Allan Poe said it best. At midnight in the month of June, I stand beneath the mystic moon and contemplate the cruel unfairness of scleroderma unawareness. Okay, Poe didn't actually write that second part, but surely he would have if he weren't one of the majority of Americans woefully ill-informed on autoimmune disease, because awareness is a prerequisite for action, and June is indeed National Scleroderma Awareness Month. This is not to be confused with festivities surrounding other autoimmune nightmares, such as Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, which is March, Lupus Awareness Month, which is October, Arthritis Awareness Month, May, or Psoriasis Awareness Month, also October. Or maybe Poe wouldn't have found a life-threatening disease of the connective tissue fitting to wax poetic about. No problem. June is also Myasthenia Gravis Awareness Month, National Aphasia Awareness Month, National Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, Fireworks Safety Month, and Host Month for Headache Awareness Week, Dystonia Awareness Week, and Helen Keller Deaf-Blind Awareness Week. Yes, this is a big country, and there are many scourges of which to be aware.
You know, there are some awareness weeks where I look at the disease and I think, I'm not even sure I've ever heard of that.
Jennifer Barrett is health editor for Newsweek magazine online.
It does prompt me to do a little research in it. So I think in some cases, it sort of puts it on your radar screen sometimes. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to write about it right now, but it increases the awareness among the press.
Barrett articulates pretty much the best-case scenario for the ever-growing awareness industry, whose foot soldiers must battle other news, other diseases, general indifference, and, in the case of June, also Potty Training Awareness Week and National Accordion Awareness Week to get Disease X on the national radar. The steward of these observances is Captain Penelope Royal, Director of the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion at the Department of Health and Human Services.
The calendar has grown a lot since we started this in 1984 when we had 43 observances for the whole year.
This year, the number is 213, not counting the dozens of observances not officially sanctioned by HHS. The sheer number is problematic, awareness-wise, because there remain only 12 months or 52 weeks to vie for the nation's disease attention. For instance, Royal scanned her calendar and alighted on May.
How about Neurofibromatosis Month?
Do you happen to know what that condition is?
If you'll let me look it up, I can do that. Here we go. Neurofibromatoses are genetic disorders of the nervous system that primarily affect the development and growth of neural cell tissues.
Well, now I know about this disease. What am I supposed to do about it?
Well, what is next? Are you going to call the organization and find out more about it? Are you going to write a check out to help them develop cures? Are you going to walk around your neighborhood and try to raise money for the group? Are you going to go to your child's school and promote awareness there? Are you going to schedule a physical examination for yourself?
The answer to all of these questions, depressingly, is no. She also might have added, are you going to devote a story to it? But the month of June is slipping away, and we media elites are inundated with disease reporting opportunities. Richard Perez Pena is Metro Health reporter for the New York Times. You working on anything about firework safety?
Actually, no. Fireworks are illegal in New York.
Scleroderma?
Scleroderma, no.
Aphasia?
Nope.
Myasthenia gravis? Dystonia?
No.
Headache?
No. Nope.
Cancer?
No. If there are awareness weeks or months about all of those, I'm unaware of them.
Because, he explains, while people like him may be generally familiar with various disease observances, they do not regard them as particularly relevant news pegs, partly because they are arbitrary and partly because no self-respecting journalist wants the news agenda dictated by outsiders, thank you very much. But did Perez Pena just a few weeks ago not do a big Metrofront story about hepatitis B smack in the middle of May's Hepatitis Month?
I have a horrible admission to make. I had no idea that there was a Hepatitis Awareness Month. It never even occurred to me.
But it occurred to the Centers for Disease Control, which timed the release of the very study he was quoting for Hepatitis Awareness Month. Because, like Big Tobacco and Big Oil, Big Liver understands message management. And it understands the challenge of breaking through public ignorance and indifference. In a recent survey, the American Liver Foundation discovered that half the population doesn't realize that hepatitis is liver disease, and 90% believe that the major cause of liver damage is not infection but alcohol abuse. Fred Thompson is president of the Liver Foundation.
The liver community has done a very bad job of focusing public attention on what liver disease actually is, exacerbated by the fact that there are over 100 different diseases. And many of those have their own little advocacy group. So there's a lot of fragmentation. And the liver community would be well served by bringing these various disparate factions together.
Easier for some organizations than for others. The Breast Cancer Pink Ribbon campaign has captured the imagination of millions. Likewise, Lance Armstrong's yellow wristbands. And colon cancer awareness got a boost when Katie Couric's husband died of the disease.
Liver was kind of just sitting back there while the other organs stepped to the plate and quite honestly have moved to the fore. We've got some catching up to do.
Do you lay awake at night wishing that Paris Hilton will get hepatitis B?
Having a celebrity or somebody like a Paris Hilton, and she happened to have liver disease and we could get her as a spokesperson, that would be probably very helpful. We all know what Katie Couric did for colon cancer. So we are hoping to find some celebrities.
God willing.
Yeah. God willing.
Relatively speaking, though, liver disease is still a marquee condition. Fred Thompson has it pretty easy next to Michael Beach, senior epidemiologist with the CDC's Division of Parasitic Diseases. Dr. Beach administers Recreational Water Illness Prevention Week.
This year, not as much pickup, but you know, in past years, we've managed to make it on the morning TV shows and that sort of thing on the national networks.
Remarkably, despite the native unsexiness of swimming pool hygiene, Beach's office has generated millions of web page views. But the fecal matter awareness message is a work in progress.
We regularly have conversations about how can we make the message more tantalizing and still be able to be tasteful and go through an approval process.
Can you give me an idea of what's been rejected?
No.
This brings us to Dan Bollinger, executive director of the International Coalition for Genital Integrity, that is, the anti-circumcision lobby. How would you characterize the general state of American genital integrity awareness?
I think so many people are involved with the decision-making process. We're talking about millions a year, and certainly we need to have a million conversations about that.
Do you think there's a million conversations going on?
There are. Unfortunately, there tend to be rather short and curt, like, well, should we cut him or her? Well, I guess so. Okay.
Yet, despite the press releases and emails, the public service announcements, and even an itsy-bitsy little march on Washington, the 2006 Genital Integrity Awareness Week came and went with barely a peep about it in the American media. And that is the cruelest cut of all. We'll be right back. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Peter Garner, Chris Worth, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, where you can also sign up for our newsletter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.